Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
This old house once knew my children. This old house once knew my wife. This old house was home and comfort as we fought the storms of life. This old house once rang with laughter. This old house heard many shouts. Now she trembles in the darkness when the lightning walks about.
Ain't gonna need this house no longer. Ain't gonna need this house no more.
Ain't got time to fix the shingles. Ain't got time to fix the floor. Ain't got time to oil the hinges. Not to mend the window pane. Ain't gonna need this house no longer. I'm a-getting ready to meet the same.
The history of Wisconsin is written in its houses, its taverns, its music halls, its corporate skyscrapers, its barns, its retail stores, its tribal meeting rooms, and its ballparks and stadiums. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we look at some of our rich heritage as we welcome two of the authors featured on the very first Wisconsin History Tour, which is also making its first stop this week in Wausau. Later in the program, we'll delve into the impact of the state's most influential sports franchise, the Green Bay Packers, as we welcome television reporter and broadcaster Jesse Garcia, the host of the Mike McCarthy Show and the author of My Life with the Green and Gold, Tales from 20 Years of Broadcasting, a woman who broke some of the traditional barriers of who is and who isn't allowed on the team bus and inside the locker room. But for the first part of the show, we welcome architectural historian Jim Drager, who will discuss a new volume called Wisconsin's Own, 20 Remarkable Homes, and will revisit his own best-selling classic, Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries, and the follow-up volume, Filler Up, The Glory Days of Wisconsin's Gas Stations. The Wisconsin History Tour exhibit is on display through Saturday at the Woodson History Museum in downtown Wausau, and you can find out more at wisconsinhistorytour.org. Now, we want to hear from you. Have you attended any of the events this week at the History Museum? Maybe you saw Patty Lowe's discussion of the history of our Indian tribes Tuesday night. Maybe you have a favorite historic tavern or a favorite building or meeting place that has meant something to you and your hometown here in north central Wisconsin. You can join our conversation at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it on the air. Jim Drager, welcome to Route 51.
Thanks.
And tell us about this Wisconsin History Tour. What's that all about?
Well, Wisconsin History Tour is the Wisconsin Historical Society's effort to bring the great riches, resources, collections of the Historical Society out into the state of Wisconsin in a way that's really visible for people.
And who organized this?
Well, it was really effort of the Wisconsin Historical Society and our partner, Wisconsin Historical Foundation. We have very rich and vast collections. And many people in Wisconsin know about us, but they don't know much about us.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to get people to know us better and get to know people in Wisconsin more.
Well, what led you to do it? What are you trying to accomplish? Obviously, you're trying to raise your own profile, but are you trying to give people an appreciation for the importance of their own local history?
Oh, sure. It's in some ways, it's our way of giving back to the people of Wisconsin. We've collected materials for over 150 years in Wisconsin history, and we want to be able to share that back. We have a very extensive website with thousands of pages of content, but that only reaches some people, and so we decided we'd go to where, bring history to where people are.
So you're taking this show on the road. Wausau is the first step, and then you'll be going to Ephraim in July, Verona in August, Racine in September, Sheboygan in October, La Crosse in November, Milwaukee in January, Green Bay in February, Eau Claire in March, Waukesha in April, and Appleton in May. So everybody around the state is going to have a chance to
see us. I'm getting my frequent driver miles.
Well, the event's been going on all this week, and we've had a number of highlights. Talk about the impact of Patty Lowe. She spoke Tuesday night. She's the author of Indian Nations of Wisconsin.
Sure. I think your viewers who call in could probably testify to the fact that that was just a spellbinding presentation. I've heard her when she was on Wisconsin Public Television, but I've never heard her speak about her book before, and I was just in enthralled, and I think everybody in the audience was. It was extremely quiet. People were not fidgeting in their seats. They were just very much focused on what she had to say, because it was quite interesting.
And we learned something about the way different people view history.
Yes.
She was saying that as Europeans or descendants of Europeans, most people in the state typically view history in a linear fashion, yeah. But for Native Americans, it's spatial. It all radiates out from a space.
Yeah, I thought that was really fascinating. That was the big revelation, I think, had people caught in their seats, was the idea that they just see history in a completely different way, and that's why they interpret things that happen differently.
And the holiness of certain places to these people, the spaces from which their history emanates,
sure.
That helps explain some of the politics that were involved in the opposition to the Crandon Mine, a holy place for the tribes.
Yes.
And the Pinoki Hills right now in northern Wisconsin.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I've worked for 26 years at the Historical Society in Historic Preservation, and that's very much focused on the importance of places. But the Native American perspective really puts the way we see historic places to shame, because it's so deep and so tied to their personhood.
And now yesterday we had a session on preserving your family photos. And then Ken and Barb Wardius, am I pronouncing their name right?
Yeah, Wardius.
Wisconsin Lighthouses, a photographic and historical guide.
Sure. Sure. You know, I'm one of those people who's struggling with all of my family photos. My father just died a year ago in April, and I got large boxes and binders full of photos. And, you know, it was a great presentation. It sort of helped you put into perspective what you should be doing with these things and how to take care of them in a way that will ensure that they last longer.
Now, today we've got Milwaukee artist Mary Knoll, and then noon, and this is all going on at the Woodson History Museum in downtown Wausau.
Right.
We've got On the Hunt, the History of Deer Hunting in Wisconsin with Bob Willing.
Sure.
And that's bound to attract at least some interest here in the North Woods, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Wisconsin's about beer, brats, cheese, the Packers, and hunting. Yeah.
And then we've got Jessie Garcia, who is a guest on this show. She'll be with us in just a few minutes talking about her years covering the Green Bay Packers. That's at 6 o'clock this evening at the Great Dane. You're taking the show on the road.
Yeah, that's what we call a Taste Traditions dinner, and we're having both a speaker on an engaging topic, and we're having food, Wisconsin food, that as a complement to that.
And then tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock, a guest who's one of the favorites on this show, Jerry Apps, who will be talking about his farm stories.
You bet.
One of the great rural farm historians in Wisconsin.
And a superb storyteller.
And then at noon, you've got For Love and Money, Portraits of Wisconsin Family Businesses with Carl
mm-hmm.
Corey.
Yeah.
And then Saturday, we've got a walking tour of historic Wisconsin. That's happening at noon, walking tour of historic Wausau, I should say. And then this community appreciation event, lots of history-related activities for kids in the Yawkey House Garden.
Sure. Yeah.
And then Karen Seaman, the author of Electa Quinney, Stockbridge teacher, will be making a presentation. The kids will have things to do like decorating kites in the old-fashioned way. And then old recess games that were probably parts of our childhood.
I would think so, yeah.
That nobody does anymore.
Right.
I tried to explain the game Kick the Can to my 18-year-old son, and I was, you know, met with glazed-over eyes.
Yeah.
But, Jim, you did your own session Tuesday on Wisconsin's 20 Remarkable Homes. Tell us about that.
Sure. We wrote a book to try to celebrate the 20 most interesting historic houses in the state of Wisconsin, and to celebrate the preservation of those buildings, because buildings don't preserve themselves. It takes people to do that. And these buildings all had fascinating histories when they were created, but then there's the history that comes after when people step in and do a restoration and save the building, sometimes save it from complete mm-hmm. and utter ruin, and, you know, bring that building back to its grandeur.
You know, in America, we've got this attitude that if something is old, it's not good. So we bulldoze our history to make way for shiny new buildings and shopping malls. You must find that disturbing as an architectural historian.
It's disturbing on a lot of levels. You know, the kind of quality of craftsmanship, the quality of materials, it can never be replicated today. We just don't have those kinds of resources anymore. And it just doesn't make sense to throw useful things into the landfill. You know, from a Greens perspective, it's utterly ridiculous to tear a building down that has a usable life and cart it to the trash heap.
Especially when it would cost 10 times the original construction cost to build something like that today.
Yes.
Well, some of these homes you were talking about, there's an octagon house in Watertown that dates back to 1854.
Sure. The octagon was an architectural fad that existed from the 1850s to the 1870s, and the idea of it was simply to try to apply science to make the most efficient house possible. And you can close the greatest amount of space with the least amount of materials if you make a sphere. So the closest practical thing to a sphere was an octagon. And so Orson Squire Fowler, who was a phrenologist, which meant that he would read the bumps and depressions in your skull and tell you about your personality, wrote a book about octagonal construction, and it became a crazy fad, and Wisconsin really got on board, and there were many octagon houses built in Wisconsin. The one in Watertown is the largest one that was constructed.
And you've got Villa Louise in Prairie du Chien, that dates from 1870, then the Harold C. Bradley House, Madison, 1909, and then Wingspread in Wind Point, 1936 to 1939.
Sure.
So to be a significant architectural treasure doesn't mean that it has to go all the way back 150 years.
That's right. Yeah, and Wingspread, for the people who might not be, the two people who may not be aware of it, was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, Wisconsin's favorite architectural son.
Local historic houses, the Cyrus Yawkey House in downtown Wausau, 1907.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Yawkey House, we included that in the book, I think, for a couple of reasons. That there's the fascinating story of Cyrus Yawkey, and he's such an important character to this part of Wisconsin because he was one of a few people who saw that the end of lumbering days were coming and that the region needed to transition to something else, or it was just going to be a boom and bust cycle. So he moves from Hazelhurst down to Wausau with a few other people, creates the Wausau Group. They dam the Wisconsin River. They build Marathon Paper. They start Wausau Insurance. They basically made Wausau what it is today.
Marathon Electric came out of that whole period of time.
Yes, Marathon Electric.
And you end up with a diversified economy.
Exactly.
Instead of one that's just based on lumbering.
That's based
on extraction. And that made Wausau different than a lot of other surrounding communities. It was able to survive.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was the true difference of Wausau.
And then we have the Walter and Mabel Fromm House in Hamburg, which was built in 1928. And that's we've done entire radio shows on the Fromms the fact that they basically created the ginseng industry in the Midwest and the silver fox industry, where they had these auctions in rural Hamburg that attracted the movers and shakers from all over the world flying into Wisconsin back into the 30s.
Yeah, they found themselves with a product that no one else could compete with. So they used to take their furs to New York to auction them. And after a while, they just said, well, you fly here if you want to buy our furs. And they did.
Well, what's significant about that home?
Well, I think the thing that's most significant about it to me is it's one of the finest crafted houses in Wisconsin. They hired a Milwaukee interior decorator to come and live in the house for 13 months and do decoration on the house. And he did a level of quality in the design that you truly don't see. For example, the living room, the walls are plastered. He tinted the plaster in the walls so it's purple on the bottom, and then it gets lighter and lighter as it moves up the wall. And it also has inscribed ornaments in it. So he did all that in wet plaster as he was laying the walls up. And it's extraordinary craftsmanship. There's a beautiful mural in the sunroom of of falling leaves. There are just a couple of leaves on the ceiling. Then there are more as you move down the wall. By the time you get to the bottom of the wall, they're just laying like a mat on the ground of the forest. It's truly stunning.
And that's still standing, and it's out in the woods in Marathon County.
It's in exquisite condition.
One of the books that you helped write, Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries, became something of a bestseller.
Yes, it was a runaway success.
Well, what's the enduring attraction of these, you know, call them what you want, taverns, bars, watering holes, stagecoach stops, breweries, speakeasies, supper clubs?
Well,
it is Wisconsin, isn't it?
It is Wisconsin. That was one of the reasons why I was so interested in writing that book is I've always thought that the tavern is something that's truly uniquely Wisconsin. It helps to define us as people. And I wanted to really understand more about why that was. And so it was our attempt to try to explain why Wisconsin has more taverns than anywhere else in the country, yet we don't drink more. We don't drink the most. We're like number six in alcohol consumption, but we're runaway number one in the number of taverns.
It started in the very early days of our history when Wisconsin was still a territory. A tavern was a stagecoach shop.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the tavern was sort of the Motel 6, the supper club, and a bar all in one.
And then we had an evolution. We had to go through Prohibition.
Yes.
Some survived, some didn't.
That's right.
Some continued selling alcohol, some didn't.
That's right. Yeah, the Prohibition time was a complete and utter disaster on so many different levels. It just didn't work, and probably the greatest legacy of Prohibition was organized crime.
Devastated the economy in Milwaukee.
It sure did. Yeah, beer was the number five industry in Milwaukee when Prohibition hit.
Well, let's look at some of these taverns real quick, because
sure.
We've got a lot on the docket today. In Hurley, Santini Bar and Hotel. That's one that kept operating during Prohibition.
Oh, yeah, and it was also a brothel. And what we thought was really remarkable at that one is the brothel rooms are still intact on the second floor yet. They never remodeled them. And it's a strange thing.
Merrill, we've got a place called Farkvim's Saloon, used to be known, or it's known now as Humphrey's Pub.
Yeah, that has one of the most spectacular and caustic tile floors in any tavern in Wisconsin, and a really magnificent back bar.
And Three Lakes, the Black Forest Tavern.
Black Forest Tavern. You know, you hear crazy stories in taverns, and you're never quite sure if they're true or not. One of the stories we heard about that one was that they had a guard wildcat. And we went to the newspapers and found out it was actually true. The wildcat's name was Mitzi, and they would leave it loose in the bar at night when the bar was closed.
Good name for a wildcat.
It was completely ineffectual as a cat, guard cat, because the tavern was robbed twice while she was on duty.
Madeline Island, Tom's Burned Out Cafe, is something familiar to a lot of tourists.
It's absolutely one of a kind. I like to say Tom's looked like the circus came to town and then it exploded and they opened a tavern on the remains.
Manitouish Waters, Little Bohemia, one of the not only one of the most significant architectural places, but a very significant place in our own history with the Dillinger shootout.
Yeah, I just credit the original owner for his foresight in knowing that he had his hands on something great, and he didn't replace the windows that were shot up by the FBI. He just put glass on either side of them. He kept Dillinger's suitcase and kept the slugs in the wall.
And they're still doing a great business today.
They are.
St. Germain, the Peacock Lodge.
Peacock Lodge is a superb example of a rustic style, you know, log northern Wisconsin tavern. And it's so much a part of that evocation of what the Northwoods is about.
Let's go down to Amherst, Sparrow's Bar, also known as the BS Inn.
Yeah, the BS Inn. You know, that one we were driving through that town looking for taverns. It was very early in the morning, and we just banged on the door. We could see the lights around. We just banged on the door until they came to the door, and we explained to them we were writing this book and wanted to look at it. And they were initially very skeptical, but they invited us in, and, you know, once they saw that we were legitimate, they were very, very nice to us.
Marshfield, you've got an old ice cream manufacturing facility that's been turned into the Blue Heron Brew Pub.
Sure. It's a great historic preservation success story. They took this old ice cream factory that was the home of the famous Susie Bar and turned it into a brew pub once the craft brew business took off.
And then we've got the Stevens Point Brewery, which managed to stay as a viable business somehow during Prohibition.
Dear to my heart, I love the Stevens Point Brewing Company. I was a student there in the 1970s and have great fond memories.
As somebody who grew up in Chicago, I remember Mike Royko, the columnist for the Daily News, writing that most beer in America tasted like it was brewed through a horse.
Yes, exactly.
And then he had a contest to see who made the best tasting beer in America, and lo and behold, it's Point Beer.
Yep.
And they weren't ready for the attention at the time.
The top three beers in that taste testing were all Wisconsin beers. And I credit Ryko for saving the Point Brewing Company, because it was under really hard times when that article came out. And like you say, they were just not ready for the success, being the number one beer in America.
And we've got a resurgence of local breweries now. Central Waters in Amherst, Bull Falls here in Wausau.
Yes. Yeah. Red Eye here in Wausau as well. Yeah. We can credit Jimmy Carter for that. Jimmy Carter was president and signed the law legalizing home brewing. And these home brewers all ran out to their basements and garages, started brewing beer, and their friend said, well, this is good enough to bottle, and some of them did. And
well his brother Billy was a pretty effective publicist,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's right.
Jim, we're gonna let you go. I want to get Jesse Garcia in here to talk about the Green Bay Packers. But
great.
Why should people care about history?
Well, I think they should care about history because history is so much a foundation of everything that we know and everything that we are. You can't be a fully formed human being if you don't have a history.
The Wisconsin History Tour, it's making its first stop in Wausau this week. It's going on at the Woodson History Center in downtown Wausau. We've got a link to it on our Route 51 Facebook page. We're going to have Jesse Garcia come in here to talk about her 20 years covering the Green Bay Packers. And if you'd like to join that conversation, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can leave a comment on our Route 51 Facebook page. I'll read it live on the air. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics, Access Prosthetics, and Gimme Shelter play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can too. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Greenwood Hills Country Club, Wausau, helping the community one round at a time with Make a Difference Mondays, a day open for all golfers to enjoy a round of golf while benefiting a Wausau area charity. Details at greenwoodhillscc.com.
We are back on Route 51 with another author on the Wisconsin History Tour in Wausau this week at the Woodson History Center as we welcome Jesse Garcia, television news and sports reporter, host of the Mike McCarthy Show, who has spent most of her career covering the Green Bay Packers and who has written a memoir entitled My Life with the Green and Gold, Tales from 20 Years of Sports Casting. Jesse, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, Glenn. Thanks for having me. A pleasure.
Tell me about the book.
About the book. Well, I wrote this book because I didn't set out to write a book at the beginning of my career. I was just doing my job. But I kept thinking to myself that things were so funny behind the scenes at a television station, also behind the scenes with a football team and all these other professional sports teams that I've covered. And I've been to 3 Super Bowls with the Packers, the White House with the Packers. We even went to Tokyo, Japan when they played a preseason game over there. had so many interesting and funny experiences. And also, for most of that time, I was trying to juggle children. I have two boys who are now 15 and 11. And so I thought that people might relate to the whole aspect of being a working parent and trying to keep all these balls in the air. So to speak. Yes. Footballs in the air. And so I sort of think of the book as having three different parts. One part is behind the scenes. The second part is being a mother and balancing all of this. And then the third part is being a woman in a very non-traditional field.
Now, if you just joined us, Jessie Garcia is on the Wisconsin History Tour. She will be speaking this evening at 6 o'clock at the Great Dane Pub in Wausau, talking about her experiences with the Green Bay Packers and 20 years of sports casting. If you'd like to talk to her right now, our lines are wide open at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Again, put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. And Jessie, as you were saying, one of the dominant themes is that struggle to balance family life with the hectic 24/7 world of television news and sports coverage.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of people have this struggle with the balance, trying to make it work both with your family and your kids and then also with whatever your chosen profession or career is. The thing about my career is that it is I work mostly nights, weekends, and holidays, which is not very conducive to family life. So when my first son was born, I mean, I have some funny moments, some funny stories to tell. My favorite picture in the book, there are 40 pictures in the book, but my favorite one of all time is when I'm changing my son's diaper. He's about 2 months old, and I'm changing his diaper in the tunnel at Lambeau Field because he had the players' tunnel where they come out onto the field. Because he had to come with me when I had to record something up there not long after he was born. And somebody snapped a picture of me changing his diaper, and that's a classic picture of me trying to balance it all.
Well, you're married to a TV photographer, so at least he can sympathize with you.
Right, yes. Yeah, actually this summer will be our 20-year anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we met in Madison at WISC at a station there, and then we came to WTMJ together. We actually both were hired on the same day, and they did not know we were married, by the way, when we interviewed. We didn't tell them.
And they hired both of you anyway.
Right. They
cool.
were expanding to add a couple of new newscasts, and we both got hired. And so we do understand each other's schedules, which is very helpful because, and the station actually knows I've been part-time ever since my older son was born, and he's now 15. And they sort of understand that only one of us can be working at a time.
Now, people who aren't in this business, who are enamored by the glamour of it, they don't understand how hard the work is, that you're working in the field 20 hours a day, you're getting just a couple of hours of sleep a night, you're sleeping in lousy hotel rooms in bad parts of the city, you're reporting, editing tape around the clock, and then doing live shots at 6 in the morning for the afternoon shows and back again at 10 o'clock, and then you got to start it all over again in the morning. People who don't understand the business are usually genuinely surprised when you tell them what
right.
it involves.
And you're eating peanut butter out of a jar from a convenience store, you know, because that's all you have time to eat. And, you know, some people may say, oh, boo-hoo, you're covering Super Bowls, you know, and cry me a million tears here. And I agree. It has been a fantastic career. It's been a great ride, and I don't want to diminish that. But there certainly are a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that are just absolutely nuts with lack of sleep, lack of food, the craziness of trying to be on the air at all of these different times of day, that sort of thing. And it's an adrenaline rush, no question about it.
And that's the thing. I mean, you're on the air, but you haven't slept in 4 or 5 days. And,
yes.
And you're on, and they expect you to look good and be coherent.
Right. And at Super Bowls, they are notorious for having these 8 a.m. press conferences. And then we're on the air. We usually have a half an hour special after the 10:30 news, so we're on the air until 11 p.m., usually far away from the hotel because we like to spread out. So we don't get back to the hotel till maybe midnight, 12:30, and then you have to be up for the 8 a.m. press conference, which is, again, at the Packers Hotel, which is not your hotel. In Dallas, for instance, that Packers Hotel was an hour away from us. So we'd have to leave at 6:30 a.m. to get there at 7:30 a.m. to set up for the press conference.
Or what's worse is when they want you to do a live shot at the at 6 in the morning.
Right, yeah. And there's a story in the book about me battling with our assistant news director because he wanted me to be on the air at 6 a.m. the day after the Super Bowl when, you know, we had just worked this incredible 17-hour work day. And
you put your foot down.
It is one of the first times that I have said no to the station. I battled with them back and forth, and I knew that my own health and safety would be in jeopardy if I were driving in the middle of the night. It was actually 5 a.m. they wanted me to be on the air, which means being there at 4:30 a.m., which means leaving the hotel at 3:30 a.m., you know.
And it's 2 a.m. when you got that assignment.
Pretty much, yeah. He wanted me to sleep for about 20 minutes.
Yeah, wonderful people in this business.
Yes.
Let's go to the phones. Gail in Pittsville. Gail, you're on with Jesse Garcia.
Hi, Jesse. This is Gail from Pittsville, and huge Packer fan.
I don't see
the back of the exciting stuff behind the scenes. I just know the family in Wisconsin. Packer games are a family reunion. It's get together, have fun. My first Packer game was my honeymoon, and I was introduced to it by his family, and it's wonderful. Packer season is the best.
Oh,
I had like a depression after it for a while.
I think we all do.
Sunday now.
I agree. You know, Packer fans have just never, ever ceased to amaze me, and because I've traveled all around the world with the Packers, I've seen in Tokyo, I was shocked by the number of Packers fans that were there, as an example. Anywhere we go, you can count on probably a fifth of the stadium being Packers fans. And that's a big thing when you're talking about going to the 49ers or wherever, you know, and,
right.
And you can have that many Packer fans.
I was going to say, even in Green Bay, my husband's family has season tickets, and, the people around us sometimes sell their tickets, and they're from Canada. Australia, you start talking to the people around you, and they're coming from all over the world to Green Bay. They want to be in Lambeau.
Sure.
And it's a great experience. It's fun. It's always fun. Even though when I first was married, they didn't really work that good.
Yes.
I lived through the 80s.
There were those lean years.
Lean years where there was actually room on the benches.
Right. And I feel very fortunate because I, you know, I graduated from college in 1992 and started working then. And so I sort of joined in at, I guess, the right time for the Packers because
we
hit the really good years there.
Friends to come along to a game, and they say, oh, we can't afford it. And it's like, no, we'll just give you the tickets. Just come along for the ride. And they say, oh, no, I got a hangnail or maybe I got to wash my hair. Something
right.
stupid like that. But back then, you couldn't even hardly give the tickets away. And then they got good, and now you...
And things have changed. Gail, thanks so much for the phone call.
Yep,
we really appreciate...
Thank you.
We appreciate your observation. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. 1-800-780-9742. We're going to take a short break right now, get it out of the way, so we can just focus on your experiences covering the Super Bowls. Three of them.
Sounds good, yes.
When we come back with Jesse Garcia, who's been covering the Green Bay Packers for 20 years. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network as we look at the history of Wisconsin.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Stevens Point Area Co-op, Peninsula Music Festival, and Import Auto Clinic. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from The Hostel Shop in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, committed to helping people rediscover the joy of cycling with recumbent trikes and a comfortable, efficient, and easy riding experience. More at hostelshop.com.
We're back on Route 51 with another author on the Wisconsin History Tour in Wausau this week. It's Jesse Garcia, television news and sports reporter, host of the Mike McCarthy Show, who spent most of her career covering the Green Bay Packers. And we're talking about her memoir entitled My Life with the Green and Gold, Tales from 20 Years of Sportscasting. Jesse, let's talk about some of those big assignments. What was it like hosting the Mike Holmgren Show and then the Mike McCarthy Show?
Well, Glenn, first I have to say I'm really enjoying all this music you're playing because it brings me right to Lambeau Field. I hear this all the time. It's great. I hosted the Mike Holmgren Show his final year in Green Bay before he left for Seattle. Of course, we didn't know at the time that it was going to be his final year. And I was 28 years old, I believe, something along those lines. And I was one of, if not the first woman to host an NFL coaches show in the entire country. And I have to say Mike Holmgren was absolutely wonderful to me. Never treated me anything differently than a professional who was there to ask him questions. We had this little meeting prior to each show where we would go over what we were going to talk about. And he was great with the audience. It was taped in front of a live audience at WBAY-TV in Green Bay. And we just had a great time that entire season. And, you know, Holmgren has four daughters, and he just mm-hmm. understands, too, you know, women, career-oriented women. I always just felt so respected by him, sort of thought of him as a fatherly type figure. And
you really were one of the pioneers, although I know you weren't consciously trying to break new ground in the feminist movement. That wasn't
right.
That wasn't your goal. But before you and a few others, sports, especially the locker room and the team bus, were the exclusive province of men.
True. And when I came out of college, again in 1992, there were no female sportscasters who were allowed to anchor a sportscast in the state of Wisconsin. There was one in Milwaukee who was only allowed to be a reporter. So I actually, at WISC in Madison, I became the first female sports anchor in the history of the state of Wisconsin.
How important was that first break that Tom Beer, the news director there, gave you?
It was huge. I had interned there over the previous summer, and I went back to college. I went to college out in Boston, and I went back to Boston, and I really wanted a job at this station, and I just bombarded them with postcards from Boston saying, you know, I'm cheap. I'll work for dirt. You know, I'll work any crazy hours you want me to. And they gave me
a
chance.
And unfortunately, they take you up on
that. Yeah, they do. but they gave me a chance, and I'm forever grateful. Van Stout was my sports director in Madison, kind of a local legend in Madison. He was absolutely wonderful to me. And, you know, it was
an old
great
school
experience.
Guy who was willing to bend with the times there.
Absolutely.
Right?
I never once felt any inkling of an issue because I was a woman. Van Stout and Jeff Lenz and the other sports anchor there, they let me do everything. I went out and shot stories, wrote stories, edited stories, and yeah, I was very grateful to WISC for giving me this break, although I have to say that they were unsure how Madison, Wisconsin was going to respond to a female sports anchor. In 1992, they were nervous. They held their breath even as they put me on the air, and the same thing happened at WTMJ in Milwaukee 2 years later in 1994. They were equally nervous about how the public would react.
But they have learned, haven't they?
I'd like to hope so. See female sportscasters everywhere now.
Now, in those early days, you did have a few unfortunate reactions. Tell us about that incident in the Cleveland Indians locker room.
Yeah, I wrote a whole chapter on the locker room because people always ask me, what is the locker room situation like? And, you know, thankfully, any Wisconsin sports teams I've never had an issue with in terms of the locker room interaction. But you brought up this one story that I did share in the book, which was the Cleveland Indians were in Milwaukee to play the Brewers at the Old County Stadium. And I was sent out to do some interviews with them. And I just have to say, to summarize it, they made me extremely comfortable from the uncomfortable from the moment I walked into that locker room. Cat calls, you know, whistles, obnoxious comments about why I was there. Sort of the ringleader of the whole thing came over, and we finally were interviewing one player, and he came over and flipped a switch on my photographer's camera.
So he was not only assaulting you, he was assaulting your photographer.
Right.
And it was Oral Hershiser, bless his heart, who finally gave you the time of day in that locker room.
Oral Hershiser was the only player, a pitcher, who said, knock it off, guys, leave her alone. And he was the only one we interviewed, and then we hightailed it out of there. And I went back in tears to my then sports director, Dennis Krause in Milwaukee, and he said, well, we're not going to take this. And he said, we're calling the Cleveland Indians PR department right now, which we did. However, the response that we got was, oh, that's just boys being boys. Don't worry about that. They're just full of fun and games. They do that all the time.
Now, you're a woman. You're going into a situation where men are dressing. They're partially clothed, sometimes even naked. How do you handle that and maintain your professionalism?
Sure. You know, I'm not going to lie. You go into a locker room, and there are people in various stages of getting themselves back together after being in a game. Although, you know, really, if you do not want to be seen in the locker room, you hide out in the trainer's room. It happens all the time. And you wait for that. There's only a specific media period, 20, 30 minutes, and then after that, media is kicked out. So, you know, a lot of times players, if they don't want to be interviewed or don't want to be seen, will stay in the trainer's room. There's actually one player, and it is Reggie White, who is the only player that I have experienced who did not believe that men or women should be in a locker room. And so he used to tell us, I'll meet you in the hallway. He said, you know me, guys, meet me in the hallway. And we would go out there and interview him there.
But he gave you the time.
Absolutely.
And maybe he gave you a more professional setting.
Right.
You know?
And he was equal. And that was all that mattered, as long as you know, it's equal between males and females. And my personal policy is to treat everybody with respect. You know, I will just turn my back on any situation. I almost always have a male photographer, and I will say, tell me when he's ready. And then, you know, we'll turn back around and go and ask him if he'd like to be interviewed.
We're talking to Jessie Garcia, the author of My Life with the Green and Gold, 20 Years of Sportscasting. She's going to be at the Great Dane in Wausau this evening at 6 o'clock. In conjunction with the Wisconsin History Tour. If you'd like to talk to her, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. She has spent the last 20 years covering the Green Bay Packers. Let's talk about some of those Super Bowls now. Let's go to the most recent one, Super Bowl 45 in Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was extraordinary to see them get back to the Super Bowl then, you know, and with a new quarterback and under this new era and all of that. And it was great. It was so exciting. I have some funny stories from that Super Bowl, though. I had to leave in the third quarter to get back out to the parking lot to be ready to go live from the parking lot as soon as the game was over. The game was on Fox, and I work at an NBC affiliate, so we cannot be live from inside the stadium. But they wanted us live the second the game was over from the parking lot. So I'm walking through the parking lot with the staticky radio that keeps cutting in and out in my ear, trying to hear the game. And all I hear is, Greg Jennings, static, 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 great play, you know, static, static.
So you're going on the air and you don't know what you're talking about.
I call our producer and I said, my radio's not working, what's happening, you know. And, yeah, so the person who's supposed to be the expert and is right there next to the stadium cannot see the game, you know, so those are just some of the funny moments.
Well, you were also in the hotel in Dallas on the 27th floor. You said the hot water came on when it wanted to. The power from all the laptops and radio stations overwhelms the system, and there's a partial blackout. And then the elevator shut down, and you're 27 floors up, and you got to be on the air, and you've got all this heavy equipment.
Yeah, I had to go down the stairs, 27 flights of stairs with two giant laptops and a backpack full of microphones, and emerge out this side entrance onto the street, and I just laughed.
You write another glamorous Super Bowl moment,
right,
in the book.
That's pretty much it. That's all you can do is laugh at some of those.
You know, nobody gave that Packer team a chance of winning it all. When did you get the feeling that this young upstart quarterback, Aaron Rodgers, and his young, inexperienced team were going to make it happen?
Yeah, well, I had a feeling about Aaron Rodgers from many, many years prior. We had done an interview with him back in the days when Brett Favre was still trying to decide, was he going to stay, was he going to go? And we requested an interview with Aaron Rodgers, who then was just this backup quarterback waiting in the wings. And Favre was still several years away from actual retirement. But I remember the interview so well because I said to Aaron Rodgers, you know, can you be the next quarterback of the Green Bay Packers? And with absolute supreme confidence, he said, of course. You know, and I said, do you believe that fans think you can be the quarterback, the next quarterback of the Green Bay Packers? And he said, probably not, but I like the challenge.
And he had big shoes to fill.
He sure did. So, you know, we had a feeling there. But really, as far as the team that year, there were so many injuries, clearly. And it wasn't until they got to the playoffs and there was something magical about those playoff wins and Charles Woodson in the locker room. I was hosting the Mike McCarthy show at the time, and we requested video of the locker room, that post-game talk that usually Mike McCarthy or one of the players will give after a victory. And we showed it each week after their playoff victories. And there was something magical about that those moments, those playoff moments. Charles Woodson, his famous one is that, you know, he got up there and said, if Barack Obama doesn't want to come see us, we're going to go see him, which was a reference to, you know, we are going to the White House because we are going to win. And it that was about the time that I thought this team has something.
Now, how was that different from the first Super Bowl you covered, Super Bowl 31, back in 1997?
Yeah, Super Bowl 31 was so new for all of us. you know, TV stations covering it, fans.
Well, the Packers hadn't been competitive since the Vince Lombardi days.
Exactly. You know, so to see them, what I remember most about that Super Bowl is how emotional people were that they were going back to the Super Bowl. And that includes Bob Harlan. We interviewed Bob Harlan in the locker room afterwards, and he broke down crying. And because this was after the NFC Championship game when they knew they were going to New Orleans. And so it was so emotional for the entire state. Friends of mine were bawling. Everybody was bawling. I was in tears, you know, covering this, because it was just filled with so much emotion. But we sort of had to feel our way in terms of a TV station covering this event. I write in the book, we sent a huge amount of people. It was something like 30 or 35 people to New Orleans to cover this. Another station decided to go the opposite and send 5 people. And, you know, it was just different stations trying to feel their way and figure out how to cover it.
Well, even here in Wausau, I was the news director at the CBS affiliate, WSAW Channel 7 at the time. We sent 3 people down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there weren't any hotel rooms.
Yes.
I spent a whole day finding a place for my crew to stay.
And that's true. Half of our crew had to stay way outside of New Orleans proper and, you know, commute in every day. I was able to get a room in the hotel, the main hotel. Actually, at that time, we were housed with the Packers in the same team hotel. But everybody was doubled up. And I was just fortunate that my husband was sent down there as well and that, you know, we were in the same room.
So, and you're used to spending time together. So.
Right.
Well, there was, one story you tell, as a woman reporter, you noticed something that your male colleagues didn't. You noticed the large ring on Mike Holmgren's finger.
Mm. Yeah, so we were in the press conference. As soon as the Packers landed in New Orleans, they have a press conference, sort of an opening, and the coach makes remarks, et cetera. And, I had been interviewing Mike Holmgren the entire year, and I noticed, now you have to imagine this room is humongous. It's one of those hotel ballrooms with the chandeliers, and there are hundreds of media members sitting there, and I was towards the back. Mike Holmgren's at the podium at the front, but I could see he had a big giant ring on I hadn't seen before, and I raised my hand, and the moderator brings the microphone over, and I asked kind of nervously because I wasn't sure if that was his Super Bowl ring from his 49ers days. And he said, oh, yes, it is. I put it on as a motivational technique for the guys. I'm going to show it to him. And he held it up, and everybody was taking pictures of it. But I remember I was just relieved that I was accurate because my biggest fear was that I would be embarrassed in front of this whole group of reporters, and he would say, what are you talking about? That's my class ring, and I've been wearing it every day for the last 10 years, and you never noticed? Something like that.
But you noticed it, and there was another situation at another point in your career in which you interviewed Michael Jordan, and your male colleagues are asking questions about three-point shots and strategy, and you asked him why he teared up during a moment of remembrance for the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing.
Yeah, they were playing a game at the Bradley Center, and they had a moment of silence before the game, and I was watching Michael Jordan during the moment of silence, and I could see how emotional he was, as were many people, because this had just happened, as I recall. And so I wanted to ask him about that, and it actually turned into a really nice soundbite and a really nice part of the story that I put together, you know, after the game. I'm not saying that nobody else could possibly notice these things.
I guess the point of my question is, does the fact that you're a woman in an all-male environment give you a different perspective?
Maybe. I will say that the Chicago reporters who were there to cover Michael Jordan were shooting me dirty looks when I was asking him this question about being emotional and tearing up. And, you know, I recall one guy, he asked the next question after me, and he said something like, well, back to basketball now, you know, and then went on to his question as if I had asked the, you know, the world's dumbest question. But I was really happy with Michael Jordan's response and the way that that piece turned out. And, you know, I think as women, maybe we're a little more tuned in to emotions and or maybe just even more willing to tell that part of the story.
Now, at the end of the book, you step back and talk about your decision to finally just say no, leave the hectic, adrenaline-based world to focus on the quiet things that are important to you, your family. your kids?
Mm-hmm.
Do you regret it?
No, not at all. The last chapter of the book is called Changes, and it is about me, making a decision to maybe pull back a little bit. So I am no longer hosting the Mike McCarthy Show. I did it for years. It was great. Mike McCarthy's fantastic, and there's a whole chapter on him as well. And I was the sideline reporter for the Packers. But I realized, again, nights, weekends, holidays, how much I was missing with my kids, even though I'm only working part-time, and I decided to pull back.
And this is a struggle for everybody in the television news business, men and women alike, trying
Indeed.
To balance family with the demands, the insatiable beast of the job.
Absolutely. The book opens with me, driving off to the Super Bowl and being upset because my young child was tugging on my leg crying, wanting me to leave.
Well, you've got time to spend with the kids.
Yeah.
And congratulations for that, Jesse.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We do want to thank today's guest, Jesse Garcia, author of My Life with the Green and Gold, Tales from 20 Years of Sports Casting, and Jim Drager, author of Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries, and Filler Up, The Glory Days of Wisconsin's Gas Stations. A reminder, the Wisconsin History Tour continues at the Woodson History Center in downtown Wausau through Saturday. Jesse Garcia will be at the Great Dane Pub tonight at 6 o'clock. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Stuart Hamblin, Sam Cooke, Todd Rundgren, the Munchkins, the Weisenheimers, and the South Beach Chamber Ensemble. Next Thursday on Route 51, we look at the history of World War II from the perspective of a man who lived it, John Rainier of Stevens Point, who served in Patton's army and documented the atrocities of the concentration camps. If you missed part of the show, you can hear it again in its entirety Friday night at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.